Chapter 51 Ray found the box midway down the corridor on the second level. The name C.K. Lee was typed on a card, and underneath it three Chinese characters. He grabbed the handle and threw open the door. There were four men in the entertainment box, all Chinese. Two of them were obviously heavies, big men in leather jackets and jeans. The other two wore suits. The heavies were standing by a buffet table covered with dishes of Chinese food and bottles of spirits and beer. The two men in suits were watching a large-screen television. Ray glanced at the screen and saw that United were winning 1-0. That wasn't good news. He slammed the door shut behind him.
"Which one of you fuckers is C.K. Lee?" he shouted.
The two men in suits turned to look at him, their mouths open in astonishment. They were both in their 60s, one with glasses, the other shorter and almost bald. They were both holding balloon glasses.
"Which one of you is C.K. Lee?" he shouted, louder this time. "I won't fucking ask again."
Both men looked towards the outside area where there were three more men, all Chinese. One of them stepped into the room. He was in his 50s, tall for a Chinese and wearing a black suit. He opened his mouth to speak, but before he could say anything, the two leather-jacketed heavies moved towards Ray. One of them was reaching inside his jacket, so Ray went for him first, punching him in the face. The man's nose spurted blood as he staggered back and slammed into a table laden with plates of Chinese dumplings. The second heavy kicked Ray, his foot slamming into his back. Ray lost his balance and he fell forward. The first heavy took the opportunity to pull out a gun from a shoulder holster, a Glock by the look of it. The man swung the gun around, but before he could point it at Ray, Ray had a hand on the man's wrist. He twisted the hand down and then quickly jerked it up, feeling the bones crack. The man yelped in pain, and the gun fell from his nerveless fingers. He clawed at Ray's face with his free hand, his fingers curled like talons, and Ray swayed backwards to avoid the blow. Then he grabbed the man's wrist with both hands and swung the arm around in a circle, bringing the man crashing to the ground. There was a popping sound as the shoulder dislocated. Ray released his grip on the man and stood up just as the second heavy moved towards him, holding a bottle of brandy above his head. Ray blocked the arm with his left forearm, then stepped forward and thrust the palm of his right hand under the man's chin. The man's head jerked back, and Ray followed it up with a slash across his throat that left him gasping for breath. The man dropped the bottle and sank to his knees, clutching at his throat, his eyes bulging from their sockets. Ray punched the man on the side of the head to make sure, and he slumped to the ground. Ray turned to face the men in suits, who were huddling against the wall by the television.
"Which one of you is C.K. Lee?" barked Ray.
One of the men started gabbling in Chinese, and Ray held up a hand to silence him.
"Do I look fucking Chinese?" he said. "Speak fucking English." "They don't speak English," said a bald Chinese guy in a black suit who'd stepped into the box from the outside viewing area.
He bent down and picked up the gun and pointed it at Ray's chest.
"Are you Lee?" asked Ray. "I'm the one with the gun, so I should be the one asking the questions," said the man. "Who are you?"
The two Chinese heavies who'd been sitting outside were now standing behind Lee looking menacing, or at least they were trying to. Ray wasn't fazed by them in the least. Looking menacing and actually being menacing were two different things.
"Gabe Savage's brother. I'm here to get his wife and kid back."
Lee grinned, showing graying teeth.
"That doesn't seem to be working out well for you, does it?"
Ray nodded at the gun in Lee's hand.
"You think that'll stop me?" "It seems to be working so far."
Lee chuckled and pointed the gun at Ray's face. He spoke to the men in suits in Chinese, and one of them put up his hand and turned up the volume of the television. A commentator was excitedly describing what was happening on the pitch below. Chelsea were on the attack. The volume was almost deafening, and it was clear from Lee's eyes that he was determined to shoot. Ray knew that he had less than a second to react. Lee was a good 6 feet away from him, too far for a kick or a punch, so he had to move. But as he sprang forward, the door to the box opened to reveal a waiter holding a tray of Chinese food. Lee hurriedly put the gun away, then rushed towards the door. He collided with the waiter, and the tray went flying as he staggered backwards. Dumpling and noodles splattered across the carpet as the tray clanged against the chair. Lee hurtled out of the door. Ray rushed after him, but his foot slipped on a dumpling and his knee twisted awkwardly. He ignored the searing pain that shot through his leg and headed for the door. A hand grabbed his arm, and Ray turned and thrust his elbow into the face of the Chinese heavy who'd grabbed him. The nose cracked, and blood spurted down the man's face. Ray chopped him across the throat with the side of his hand, and the man released his grip on Ray's arm. The second heavy was stepping into the box, so Ray grabbed the man with the bloody nose and threw him across the room. The two men collapsed in a heap on top of the waiter. Ray ran out into the corridor. Chapter 52. Chelsea had the ball and were getting ready to make their move. One of their forwards made a break for the United goal, but Michael Devereux was on him, as close as a shadow. Johnny Reed lunged at the ball and managed to get his foot to it, and it skidded across the grass towards Fernandez. The Argentinian trapped it, turned, and headed towards the Chelsea goal. At the same time, Babacar made his move, feinting left and breaking right. The defender marking him as wrong-footed, and Babacar was on his own. Before he could shout for the ball, Gabe yelled at Reed, "To me, Johnny!" Reed hesitated, saw that Babacar was unmarked, but then Gabe shouted again, and Reed chipped the ball to him. Gabe ran with it, tapping the ball from foot to foot. He spotted a gap to his right, and he went for it. Babacar had crossed across the penalty box and was now on the left of the goal, frustration etched into his face. He was being marked again, and as Gabe looked over, he saw the defender grabbing Babacar's shirt. Gabe drew back his right foot and sent the ball curving through the air towards the goal mouth. Babacar moved to intercept it, but the defender yanked him back, and the goalkeeper beat him to it, snatching the ball from the air, taking a step, and kicking it high and hard towards the middle of the pitch. Babacar appealed to the referee, but the referee was already running after the ball. Babacar glared at Gabe and threw up his hands. Gabe ignored him and jogged towards the centre of the pitch. Chapter 53. Ray ran down the corridor, arms pumping, his rapid footsteps echoing off the walls. Lee was at the far end, heading for the stairs. When Ray reached the end of the corridor, he couldn't see if Lee had gone up or down. He listened, but all he could hear was the roar of the crowd. He knew he had to make a decision. In times of danger, people tended to go up, he knew that, but he also knew that all the exits were down. He headed down the stairs. He took a quick look along the corridor on the first level. There were stewards there and a couple of guys in suits heading for the toilets, but no sign of Lee. Ray ran downstairs to the ground level. Two female stewards looked at him inquisitively, and Ray slowed to a walk. "You okay, sir?" asked the elder of the two stewards, a heavy-set brunette with her hair tied back. "Oh, looking for one of our clients," said Ray. "Chinese guy in a black suit, bald, 60s maybe. He's supposed to be in our box, but I think he's got lost."
"You just missed him," said the steward. She pointed down towards the toilets. "He went that way just now."
"Did he go in the toilets?"
The woman shook her head.
"I don't think so."
"Thanks," said Ray.
He jogged in the direction she'd pointed. A roar went up from the pitch, followed by a massive collective groan and catcalls. A whistle blew. As he turned the corner, he saw Lee. He had his hand inside his jacket, concealing the gun. There were several stewards hanging around and CCTV cameras everywhere. Ray headed towards him. Lee hurried away past a stall selling pies, then turned into another stairwell. There was a sign above it that read, "Employees only." By the time Ray got to the stairwell, Lee had gone through a door with another sign on it, this one saying, "Maintenance tunnel." Ray grabbed the handle and pulled open the door. Beyond was a concrete-lined tunnel that ran under the pitch, allowing access to the irrigation and drainage systems. A line of fluorescent lights ran down the middle of the tunnel, flooding it with a clinical white light. There were pipes crisscrossing the roof and running down the sides. Lee was about 50 feet inside, hurrying as fast as he could. Ray let the door close behind him and started jogging down the tunnel. Chapter 54. Laura smiled encouragement at Ollie.
"Come on, honey, you're almost here."
Ollie was about 3 feet from the side of the bed she was sitting on. There were tears of frustration in his eyes, and he kept looking fearfully over at the door.
"Keep looking at me, honey. Just look at me."
"My feet hurt," he whispered. "My feet
hurts so much.
I know they do, honey, she said, but try to think like Daddy. Every time he goes out on the field to play, his legs hurt. You know they do. But he pushes himself and he gets through. You can too, honey. I know you can.
Holly smiled.
Okay.
He started moving again, an inch or so at a time. His toes clawed into the carpet. He shuffled forward, and then he relaxed. It had taken him more than 10 minutes to move a few feet, but he was making progress, and the carpet was muffling any sound. She kept her eyes fixed on his as he slowly made his way towards her.
Good boy, she whispered. I'm so proud of you.
It took another 5 minutes of inching towards the bed before he was close enough, and she told him to turn around and put the clippers on the bed. It took him almost 2 painful minutes until his back was to her. She could see the clippers in his right hand.
Okay, honey, just lean back and toss them onto the bed.
I can't, Mum, I can't.
Yes, you can, honey. You can do it.
He drew back his hand and flicked it, and the clippers arced through the air, but they fell short, hit the side of the bed, and fell onto the carpet.
I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, he said.
Tears ran down his face.
I'm so stupid.
No, you're not, said Laura. You're very clever and you're very brave. There's no need to cry. Look at me, honey. Come on, turn and look at me.
He did as he was told and slowly turned around.
Look at me, honey, said Laura.
Ollie raised his eyes and blinked away his tears. Laura ached to be able to hug him and kiss him and wipe the tears away, but that wasn't an option. Ollie had to get a grip on himself because he was their only hope.
Listen to me, honey. It's going to be all right, I swear. We'll be home, and Daddy will be there, and everything will be okay.
Ollie nodded tearfully.
All right.
Here's what you need to do, honey, okay? Very carefully, go down on your knees. Then sit down. Be quiet. Be very quiet. When you're sitting down, you'll be able to reach the clippers. Then you stand up again.
I'm scared, Mum.
I know you are, honey. But you can do this. I know you can.
Chapter 55. Ray reached the halfway point of the maintenance tunnel. Lee was 60 feet away, jogging and breathing heavily. There was an electrical junction box on the wall with a sign that said, "Warning, electrical hazard." Leaning against it was a long-handled wooden brush. Ray grabbed it as he went past. Lee stopped and turned to face Ray, pulling out his gun. He pointed it at Ray. He held it with one hand and it wavered as he tried to aim at Ray's chest.
"What do you want?"
he asked. "I told you what I want," said Ray. "Gabe's family."
He walked towards Lee, swinging the brush.
"Where are they?"
Lee pulled the trigger, but the shot went wide and ricocheted off the wall near Ray's head. Ray ducked, even though ducking would have done no use at all if the gun had been on target. Ray guessed that Lee wasn't used to handling guns, which was handy, but even a shit marksman would eventually get lucky in the confines of the tunnel. When he realized he'd missed, Lee turned and started running, and Ray figured that was a mistake. Lee must have realized by now that Ray wasn't armed. His best option would be just to walk towards Ray and shoot him. Not that Ray was complaining. He was more than happy to have Lee running away from him. Lee was obviously a man who was used to getting others to fight his battles, whereas Ray's background was more hands-on. Ray was younger and fitter and was no stranger to physical violence. Ray was gaining on Lee, but the man was still 30 feet or so ahead of him when he stopped and turned and brought up the gun. Ray kept running and threw the brush. It spanned through the air and Lee fired wildly, the bullets hitting the ceiling in a shower of sparks. The brush hit him on the shoulder and Lee pushed it away, cursing. It clattered to the floor. Ray was still running, and by the time Lee had steadied himself, Ray was just a few feet away. Lee's eyes were wide, and his hand was shaking, but his finger was tightening on the trigger. Ray dropped down and slid the last few feet, his right foot catching Lee's left ankle. Lee fell, and Ray rolled out of the way. As Ray pushed himself up, Lee was on his side, the gun still in his hand. Ray used the wall to steady himself as he got to his feet. Lee was gasping for breath, stunned from his fall. Ray stamped down on the man's wrist, and Lee's hand opened, releasing the gun. Ray kicked it away. Lee lashed out with his foot and caught Ray behind the knee, and he lost his balance, falling against the wall. By the time Ray had straightened up, Lee was standing in the middle of the tunnel, gasping for breath, and holding the brush in front of him like a broadsword. Ray couldn't help grinning.
"Seriously?" he said. "You're giving me the brush off?"
Lee frowned, not understanding. He faked a blow to Ray's head, but Ray stood his ground. Lee lashed out again, harder this time, and Ray swayed back. Lee drew back the brush for a third time, and Ray rushed him, grabbing the pole with his left hand and thrusting his right palm up under Lee's chin and forcing his head back. Ray kept his momentum going and slammed Lee against the tunnel wall. The brush slipped from his grasp and clattered to the floor. Ray drove his knee into Lee's groin, and Lee howled in pain.
"Where's Laura?" shouted Ray.
He grabbed him by the lapels, swung him around, and slammed him against the other wall. Lee clawed at Ray's eyes, and Ray let go. Lee put up his hands and took a fighting stance, but he was clearly hurt and exhausted.
"Are you fucking serious?" asked Ray. "You want to fucking fight me? I'm younger, stronger, fitter, and I've been doing this for years. Stop fucking about and just tell me where they are, or I swear I'll kick the living shit out of you."
Lee lashed out with his right leg, but he was slow, and there was no power behind the blow. Ray caught the leg easily and held it, forcing Lee to hop back, arms flailing. Ray punched Lee in the face, keeping a tight grip on the leg with his left hand.
"Where is Laura? Where's the kid?"
Lee's nose was bleeding, but he didn't answer. Ray punched him again, and again.
"Where the fuck are they, Lee?"
Lee shook his head, and Ray punched him again. Lee tried to claw at Ray's face again, but Ray's next punch was so hard that Lee's head snapped back and he collapsed. Ray let go of the leg and took a step back as Lee fell to the floor. Lee's head hit the ground hard and his eyes closed. Ray kicked him in the side, hard, but there was no reaction. Ray cursed. He knelt down by the unconscious man and patted him down. He found a wallet in his right trouser pocket, and he pulled it out and flicked it open. There were several credit cards, a wad of £50 notes, and a UK driving license. He tossed the wallet down and squinted at the address on the license, North London. He straightened up and slipped the driving license into his back pocket, then picked up the gun, ejected the magazine and checked the clip. It was empty. He tossed the gun onto the body. Dead or unconscious? Ray didn't care. He started running down the tunnel, back the way he'd come.
Chapter 56. Mancini chipped the ball over to Gabe. Gabe trapped it and turned in one smooth movement, feinted left and went right. He took the ball 20 feet closer to the Chelsea goal, unchallenged. There were two Chelsea defenders in front of him, waiting to see which way he'd run. Gabe slowed. Off to his right, Moretti was trying to find space, but failing. Off to the left, Reed was shouting for the ball. Reed had a clear run for the Chelsea goal and was the obvious choice. Babacar was standing still, a Chelsea defender to his right. Babacar had no clear shot for goal and would have to break to his left, which was his weaker side. The defenders rushed forward, and Gabe sent the ball high towards Babacar. Gabe saw the look of confusion on Babacar's face. The striker had obviously assumed that the ball would be going to Reed, and he hesitated for a fraction of a second before jumping for the ball. He managed to get his head to it and nod it towards Moretti. Moretti ran for it, but he was shoulder-charged and lost his balance. By the time he'd recovered, Chelsea had the ball and were heading for the United goal. There were catcalls and boos from the fans, mainly aimed at the defender who'd hit Moretti. McNamara was shouting from the sideline, but his voice was lost in the crowd. Gabe looked over at Babacar. Babacar was standing with his hands on his hips, shaking his head in disgust. Gabe shrugged an apology and jogged back to the centre line.
Chapter 57.
"I can't get it, Mum. I'm sorry," said Ollie.
He was lying on his side on the floor so Laura couldn't see him.
"I just can't reach it."
"Keep trying, honey," said Laura. "Take your time."
"But I can't move my hands. They've gone numb."
"Try wiggling your fingers, honey. That'll get the circulation going."
I'm sorry, Mum.
Honey, you've got nothing to be sorry about. Just keep trying. Holly sniffed.
Okay.
She heard him move, then sigh, then move again.
Mum, I've got it,
he whispered excitedly. Good boy. Now, stand up, quietly, okay?
Okay, Mum.
Laura heard several soft grunts, and she felt him bang against the bed.
Quietly, Ollie,
repeated Laura in a harsh whisper.
Okay, okay.
Laura heard him grunt, then she saw the back of his head appear above the side of the bed. He pushed with his feet and slowly stood up. Laura's eyes widened when she saw the stainless steel nail clippers in his right hand.
Well done, Ollie, she said. I'm so tired and my hands hurt, he said.
I know, she said, but we're almost there. Now, sit down on the bed so that they don't fall back on the floor.
Ollie did as he was told.
Now, flick them back as far as you can, said Laura.
Ollie tossed the clippers onto the bed. They landed a few inches away from Laura's stomach.
Well done, Ollie, she whispered.
She wanted nothing more than to hold her son and kiss him and make it all better, but that wasn't going to happen for a while.
I'm so tired, Mum, he said. I know you are, honey, but now you have to get back to the sofa. My feet hurt. Just take it nice and slowly, she said.
I want to stay here, with you on the bed, he said.
The man might come back, she said.
I don't care, said Ollie. He sniffed. I just want to be with you, Mum.
Tears pricked Laura's eyes.
Okay, she said. Lie down for a while.
Really?
Sure.
Ollie swung his legs up onto the bed and lowered his head to the pillow. Laura moved closer to him and she kissed him on the cheek.
I'm so proud of you, she said. I'm really scared.
It's going to be all right, she said.
Though she wished she was as confident as she sounded. Even if she did manage to cut the duct tape, they were still trapped in a house with armed men who were threatening to kill them if Gabe didn't do what they wanted. Chapter 58 Ray hurried towards the exit. Two stewards were standing at the gate, and they looked quizzically at Ray.
Are you okay, sir?
Asked the elder of the two, a grey-haired man holding a transceiver.
I need to get out, said Ray.
The steward looked at his watch.
It's not even half time yet,
he said. There was a roar from the stand behind them, followed by groans and catcalls.
Oh, I know. Family problems, said Ray. Can you let me out?
Just go through the turnstile, said the steward.
Cheers, said Ray.
He pushed through the turnstile and started running down the pavement.
Hey, mate, can I have your ticket?
Shouted a young man wearing a Chelsea shirt. Ray ignored him and ran on. Behind him, he heard the crowd roar, followed almost immediately by howls of despair. Chapter 59 One of the Chelsea defenders kicked the ball upfield, but he mistimed it, and the ball cannoned off Mapplethorpe's leg and bounced over the sideline. Gabe jogged over to the sideline in preparation for the throw-in. Babacar joined him.
"What the fuck's going on, Gabe?"
asked Babacar.
"What do you mean? I've not had a decent cross from you all game," said the striker. "Are you trying to make me look bad?"
"They're on you like shit on a shoe," said Gabe. "You need to make more space."
Babacar shook his head.
"Just give me the ball when I've got a chance of getting it," he said. "I'll do the rest."
Gabe nodded, but didn't reply. He looked over at the referee. The referee blew on his whistle, and a Chelsea player ran with the ball, stopped, and threw it hard and high. Gabe and Babacar gave chase. The ball landed at the feet of one of the Chelsea strikers, who headed off towards the United goal. Michael Devereux rushed towards the player with the ball and forced him to veer left, where Mancini executed a perfect sliding tackle that sent the ball spinning back towards Gabe. The crowd roared as Gabe trapped it, turned on the spot, and ran towards the Chelsea goal. Babacar was to Gabe's right, slightly ahead of him, shouting for the ball. Gabe tapped it to Babacar, a perfect pass that Babacar couldn't complain about. Off to the right, Moretti was making a run, but he was far too early, so Babacar turned and tapped it back to Wood before running towards the Chelsea goal. The crowd began to roar, sensing that something was about to happen. Wood passed the ball back to Mapplethorpe. Mapplethorpe sent it across to Mancini, and Mancini ran with it, passing two Chelsea players on the left wing before crossing it to Gabe. Gabe was unmarked and was able to take the ball into the Chelsea half before he faced any opposition. Babacar was on the edge of the penalty area. The goalkeeper was on his line, moving from side to side, shouting at his defenders. Babacar twisted around, feinted left, and then ran towards the goal, his eyes on Gabe. Gabe heard heavy breathing behind him, and he dribbled the ball to the left, turned to the right, and sent the ball high in the air towards Babacar. Babacar was lined up to head the ball into the right-hand corner of the goal, but Gabe had kicked the ball to the striker's other side. Babacar changed direction and managed to get his head to the ball, but he was off balance and the ball went over the crossbar. Babacar landed awkwardly, slipped and fell. The United fans groaned in unison. Babacar got to his feet and rubbed the dirt from his hands. The goalkeeper retrieved the ball and the referee blew his whistle for the goal kick, and Babacar jogged out of the penalty box. Gabe looked up at the clock atop the scoreboard. It was almost 3:30. United were still ahead, which meant that somehow Gabe had to make sure that Chelsea scored at least twice. Chapter 60. Ray ran full pelt through the city streets, knowing that time was running out. It had to be half-time now, 45 minutes plus injury time to go. He slowed as he reached the garage. His BMW was parked where he'd left it, but there were two men leaning against it, men he recognised, Mike Tyler and Barry Chisnell. Their black Range Rover was parked at the roadside. Ray cursed but forced a smile.
Guys, he said amiably, what's up?
Don't fuck around, Ray, said Mike.
His hand moved inside his jacket.
That hand appears with a gun in it, and you and I have a problem, warned Ray.
Don't make this any more difficult than it has to be, said Barry.
His hand was also inside his jacket.
How the fuck did you find me? Asked Ray.
Are you serious? Said Mike. The amount of mayhem you've been causing, you think no one has noticed? You've gone rogue, Ray, and Den's had enough.
I've spoken to Den. I've explained.
Mike shook his head.
No, you haven't, mate. You haven't explained anything.
Ray held out his hand.
Give me the keys, Mike.
Mike nodded at the Range Rover.
Get in the car, Ray. Don't make this any more difficult than it has to be. All you have to do is talk to Den. Smooth things over.
Ray reached into his jacket for his phone. Barry pulled out his Glock and pointed it at Ray's chest.
For fuck's sake, Barry, can't you see he's going for his phone? Said Mike.
Ray took out his phone and sneered scornfully at Barry.
Fine. I'll talk to him.
Face to face, Ray, said Mike. He wants a face-to-face.
I don't have time, Mike. Now give me the fucking keys.
I've had enough of this shit, said Barry, waving his gun. Get in the fucking car.
Yeah? You're going to fucking shoot me, said Ray.
I will if I...
Ray moved so quickly that his hands were a blur. His left hand slapped Barry's gun to the side. His right hand slapped into Barry's wrist and twisted. Barry's fingers opened involuntarily, and Ray's left hand grabbed the barrel. Ray stepped back, transferring the gun to his right hand. It had taken less than a second.
For fuck's sake, Ray, said Mike.
He raised his hands to show that he had no intention of reaching for his own gun. Ray kept far enough away from the two men so that neither of them could grab the weapon. Barry stared at the gun in amazement, trying to work out what had just happened.
Krav Maga, said Mike. The Israeli self-defense program. Ray's a bit of an expert.
Ray stepped forward and lashed out with the gun, catching Barry on the side of the head. Barry slumped to the floor without a sound.
When he wakes up, tell him not to stand so close when he pulls a gun on someone.
Will do, said Mike. Den's going to be furious, you know that.
He is already, right?
Mike shrugged and slowly lowered his arms.
Give me the keys, Mike.
Mike slowly reached into the pocket of his trousers.
On second thoughts, give me the keys for the range.
Ray tucked the gun into his belt and held out his hand.
You're stealing my fucking car.
It's Den's car, and I'm not stealing. I'm swapping. You're right. I've been attracting attention in the Beamer, so you take it, and I'll take the range.
Mike sighed and handed over the keys to the SUV.
Are you sure you know what you're doing, Ray?
No, said Ray. I'm not, but I don't have any choice. Now, keep the fuck away from me. Next time, I won't be so pleasant.
Mike raised his hands in surrender and kept them in the air as Ray jogged over to the Range Rover and climbed in. As Ray drove off with his tyres squealing, Mike squatted down next to Barry. Barry moaned and moved his head from side to side. Then his eyelids flickered open.
Oh, who was that masked man? Groaned Barry.
Mike grinned and patted him on the shoulder.
I'm glad you still got your sense of humour. Because when Den finds out what just happened, he's going to tear you a new one.
Did he take me gone?
Yes, he took your gun.
Fuck.
Yeah. What were you thinking? Putting a gun on Ray Savage. That was only ever going to end one way.
Barry groaned.
I got caught up in the moment.
I think you'll need to come up with something better than that for Den, said Mike. You might want to give it some thought.
Chapter 61 Laura rubbed her forehead against Ollie's shoulder.
Honey, you're going to have to go back to the sofa. I want to stay here with you, Mum.
I know, but if that man comes back and finds you on the bed, he's going to be angry. You need to go back to the sofa.
I'm tired, Mum.
She kissed his shoulder.
I know, honey, but you can rest on the sofa.
Okay, said Ollie.
He sniffed, then slowly swung his legs off the bed. He stood up, sniffed again, and began shuffling back to the sofa. Laura rolled onto her right side and groped for the nail clippers. She rolled them into her right hand, closing her eyes and trying to picture them. One of the handles had to be swung around so that pressure could be applied to the blades. She bit down on her lower lip as she concentrated. Eventually, she managed to do it and used her thumb to click the cutters closed. Her heart was racing, and she took a couple of deep breaths to steady herself. She twisted the clippers around in her hand, trying to find the duct tape by feel. She clicked the blades closed, but they didn't bite down on anything. She twisted her hand more and clicked again. Still nothing. She took another deep breath and tried again. This time, the clippers slipped from her sweating fingers, and she cursed.
"Are you okay, Mum?" asked Ollie.
"I'm fine," she said. "I'm trying to use the clippers."
She groped around with her bound hands and found the clippers. She took them in her right hand and swiveled them around.
"Keep going, honey. You need to get on the sofa."
"Okay, Mum."
Laura pushed the clippers against the duct tape and pressed down with her thumb. There was no resistance, and she realized she'd missed the tape. She tried again, and this time she felt the clippers bite against the tape.
It was going to work, she realized. It would take time, but it would work.
Chapter 62 Ray tapped the address from Lee's driving license into the Range Rover's sat-nav as he drove, one eye on the road and one eye on the screen. He pressed the button for the route and smiled thinly when he saw that Lee's house was just 16 minutes away, providing he didn't hit traffic. He stamped on the accelerator. He reached a set of lights just as they turned to amber, and he pressed down on the accelerator. He went through on red, and he saw the junction was covered by CCTV cameras. It wasn't a problem. Den Donovan's cars were as disposable as Ray's. A black cab pulled out in front of him, and Ray swerved around it, narrowly missing a double-decker bus. The bus driver sounded his horn, but Ray had already gone. The Range Rover wasn't the most responsive of vehicles, but Ray kept his foot down as he powered through the traffic, overtaking where he could. There were two buses ahead of him, and the road narrowed, so he ignored the sat-nav, turned into a side street, and did a series of quick right and lefts. The sat-nav kept recalibrating, but Ray paid it no attention. 5 minutes later, he was back on the main road, and he smiled as he saw the two buses in his rearview mirror. He reached another set of lights, but they were already on red, and there were several cars ahead of him. He sat drumming his hands on the steering wheel for a few seconds, then swore out loud, pulled around the two cars, and drove through the red light. A white van had to brake to avoid hitting him, and a motorcyclist swerved out of his way. The bike and the van driver sounded their horns angrily, but Ray was totally focused on the road ahead of him. Chapter 63 The referee blew his whistle and awarded a free kick to Chelsea.
The tackle by Fernandez had looked okay to Gabe, but he'd been on the other side of the pitch. Fernandez was protesting vociferously, but the referee waved him away. Fernandez wouldn't accept the decision and he ran around to get in the ref's face, shouting and waving his arms around. Gabe ran over to placate Fernandez. Bad decisions were a fact of life. There was no point in getting upset about them, especially if they resulted in a yellow card or a sending off. Tim Mapplethorpe had joined in, shouting that the tackle had been legal, but the referee waved him away too. The player who'd gone down was massaging the back of his leg and wincing, but it looked like play-acting to Gabe.
"Are you fucking blind?" Mapplethorpe screamed at the referee. "He didn't touch him. He played the ball and he got the ball."
The referee was red-faced and clearly upset. His hand went to his pocket, presumably to pull out a yellow card, but Gabe rushed in between him and the players and pushed Mapplethorpe and Fernandez away from the official.
"Let it go, guys," he said.
"The tackle was good," said Fernandez. "I never touched him."
"Referees make mistakes," said Gabe. "Get over it."
"I didn't touch him, Gabe."
"I believe you. Just let it go."
He ushered Fernandez away. One of the Chelsea players put the ball down. The referee blew his whistle and the kick was taken. A quick chip to one of the Chelsea midfielders who ran with it to the halfway line. There he passed it to a teammate on the right wing who was promptly shouldered by Mancini. Mancini got the ball, but the player shouldered him back, and as the two men struggled, the ball rolled over the sideline. The referee ran over and awarded the throw-in to Chelsea. It was a long throw and caught United by surprise. A Chelsea midfielder snapped it up and sprinted towards the United goal. Devereux moved to intercept and managed to take the ball off him before quickly back-heeling it to Mancini, who then booted it all the way up the field. It all happened so quickly that the entire Chelsea team were wrong-footed. Gabe realised that the ball was coming straight to him and that the nearest Chelsea player was 20 feet away. He jumped to trap the ball on his chest, let it drop to his feet, and then turned and started running. There was one defender in front of him, and Gabe slowed. Babacar had sprinted down the opposite wing and was unmarked. Gabe couldn't see that he had any choice other than to pass to Babacar, but if he did, there was a good chance that he'd score. He continued to move forward, then kicked the ball towards Babacar, but he sent the ball behind the striker so that he had to reverse direction to get it. Babacar saw what was happening and tried to stop his run, but he was too slow, and the ball bounced over the sideline, a good 6 feet behind him. Tens of thousands of disappointed fans groaned as one. Babacar shook his head in disbelief. The referee blew his whistle and a Chelsea player threw it in, straight to the head of a teammate. The ball cannoned past Moretti, straight to the feet of a Chelsea striker who ran full pelt towards the United goal with Moretti in hot pursuit. Ronnie Watts moved off his line, his arms outstretched. The striker was fast and pulled away from Moretti. Devereux and Mancini ran to intercept the player, but before they reached him, he took his shot. It was a blistering volley that Watts made a valiant attempt to reach, but his headlong dive missed by inches and the ball powered into the back of the net. The Chelsea fans went wild, cheering and whooping, while the United supporters sat in stunned silence. The referee blew his whistle. He was to Gabe's left, and as Gabe looked over, the official took his whistle from his mouth and grinned. "Nice one," he said, before running over to the centre spot. Gabe stared after him, wondering what the man had meant. Had he realised that Gabe had deliberately fluffed his pass? And did his comment mean that he knew why Gabe had done it? The men who wanted United to lose the match had kidnapped his wife and child. Had they also got to the referee? Chapter 64. Ray glanced over at the sat-nav. Lee's house was 12 minutes away. The Range Rover was caught in traffic again, and Ray couldn't see any rat runs on the screen. He tapped the steering wheel impatiently. The hold-up was a van unloading office supplies. The driver had parked on double yellow lines and didn't seem in the least concerned about the tailback he was causing. When he returned from a shop and started pulling a box from the rear of his van, Ray got out and jogged over to him. He was big, with a shaved head and the tattoo of a cobweb across his neck, with puffy ears that suggested he'd been a boxer at some point, and not a good one. He was wearing dark blue overalls with the name of a courier on the back. Ray tapped him on the shoulder. The man turned, a massive beer gut straining at the material of the overalls. Ray saw that he had love tattooed across the knuckles of his left hand and hate on the right. Ray needed his game face on, and he had to resist the urge to smile. He had never yet come across anyone with tattoos like that who didn't fold at the first punch.
"You need to move your van now, mate," said Ray.
"What are you, fucking traffic warden?"
sneered the man. Ray punched him in the face, hard enough to make his nose bleed, but not hard enough to break it. The man stepped back, blood streaming down his chin.
"For fuck's sake," he said.
"Move it," said Ray.
The man looked at the blood on his hands in amazement.
"You hit me," he said,
as if he couldn't believe what had happened.
"And if you don't move that fucking van now, I'll break your fucking legs," said Ray, pointing at the man's bloody face. "Now, fucking move it."
Ray took a step towards the man, and he stumbled back against the van.
"Okay, okay,"
said the man, wiping his nose with his sleeve. He slammed the rear doors shut and hurried to the front of the van. Seconds later, he was driving down the road. Ray went back to the Range Rover. Two of the drivers in front of him gave him a thumbs up, but a middle-aged woman shook her head disapprovingly. By the time Ray got back into his car, the road was clear, and he was soon powering along at 50 miles per hour, well over the speed limit. Chapter 65. Chelsea had the ball in the middle of the pitch, tapping the ball back and forth as they probed for an opening. One of their strikers was just outside the penalty box, but Tim Mapplethorpe was on him and cutting him no slack. Ronnie Watts was moving up and down the goal line, calling for Devereux to move to the side. A Chelsea midfielder made his run and haired down the left wing. The cross was perfect, low and fast and straight to his feet. He took three steps, then sent it in a high, curving pass towards the striker, but Mapplethorpe had it covered, and the two men jumped at the same time and the striker fell forward. Watts scooped up the ball, ran and kicked it with all his might. The ball arced up into the air and almost made it to the halfway line. Wood trapped it, swerved by a Chelsea defender, and sent it skimming across the turf to Gabe. Gabe's way was blocked by two Chelsea players, so he tapped it to the left to Armati. Armati did a cute back heel and spin to shrug off the player marking him and kicked it across to Wood. Babacar had made his run and was at the edge of the penalty box. Wood feinted left, then went right, and kicked the ball high towards Babacar. The crowd was roaring in anticipation of a United goal, but the ball was still in the air when the whistle blew, long and hard. Half-time. Chapter 66. Laura felt the jaws of the clippers grip the duct tape, and she pressed down with the thumb. The jaws clicked. She pulled at her wrists, but the tape felt just as secure as when she'd started cutting the tape. She had no way of judging her progress. All she could do was to keep cutting as best she could. Her hands were dripping with sweat, and several times the clippers had slipped from her fingers. Her hands were hurting, and her right wrist was sending lancing pains up through her arm. Tears of frustration ran down her cheeks, but she tried not to make any sound because she didn't want to worry Ollie. She took a deep breath, then twisted her hand and tried to find the duct tape with the clippers. She closed her eyes as she concentrated, visualizing the tape around her wrists and the jaws of the clippers closing on it. She felt resistance against the clippers and pressed down with her thumb. There was a faint clicking sound, but she had no way of knowing whether she'd cut the tape or not. She strained at her bonds, but they held tight. She blinked away the tears and tried again. Chapter 67. Gabe was the first into the changing rooms, and he hurried over to his locker. He'd just opened it when he felt a shove between his shoulders. He stumbled against his locker door and turned to see Babacar glaring at him.
"What the fuck are you playing at, man?"
hissed Babacar.
"What do you mean?" said Gabe.
"You know what I fucking mean," said Babacar. "Every pass you sent me out there was off, late or early. You're trying to get me killed?"
"Don't be fucking stupid," said Gabe, pushing him away. Babacar pushed him back, and Gabe slammed against his locker door.
"You need to get your fucking head straight, because I got hit twice out there because of you," said Babacar. "And I got hit fucking hard."
"Don't blame me because you're having a bad game," said Gabe.
Babacar shoved Gabe again. This time, Gabe pushed back hard with both hands, sending Babacar staggering backwards. Babacar bunched his right hand into a fist and launched himself at Gabe, but Michael Devereux grabbed him from behind and pulled him away.
"Cool it, Omar," he said.
The door opened, and McNamara walked in. He frowned when he saw Devereux struggling with Babacar.
"What the fuck's going on?"
asked the coach. Devereux let go of Babacar and held up his hands.
"Just horseplay," he said.
"Omar?"
asked McNamara. Babacar shrugged but didn't say anything. He went to grab an energy drink. Gabe turned away and opened his locker door. McNamara went over to Babacar.
"What's going on?"
Babacar shrugged.
"Nothing," he growled, as he twisted the cap off the bottle.
He drank greedily and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
"All good, Joe."
"You sure?" Babacar nodded.
"I'm sure."
McNamara walked into the middle of the changing rooms.
"Right, listen up," he said. "The boss will be in any moment, but I want to get my two pennyworth in first. I know that didn't go as we'd expected, but 1-0 is no bad thing, providing we go in hard in the second half. We had a few good opportunities out there, and we could easily be 3-1 right now. Let's get our heads straight and go back out there, fighting. Okay?"
There were nods and a few yes from the team. Gabe picked up his phone. There was a text message from an unknown number. His heart raced as he pressed the screen to read it. "A draw is no good. You must lose if you want to see your family again." Tears pricked Gabe's eyes, and he tossed the phone back into his locker and slammed the door shut. The door to the changing room was pushed open, and Piero Gattuso strode in. The manager had taken off his overcoat to reveal a Savile Row dark blue suit, a blue silk shirt and a dark blue tie. Gold cufflinks peeped from under his sleeves. He strode into the middle of the room and stood with his feet splayed out as he waited for quiet. His cheeks were more flushed than usual, and Gabe figured the wine had been flowing freely in the owner's box.
"Well, at least we're not losing," said Gattuso.
He flicked back his mane of grey hair.
"That's about all I can say. The owner isn't happy, obviously. Like me, he thinks we should be winning this game. He doesn't understand what's going wrong, and frankly, I'm at a loss. We made too many mistakes out there, right, Joe?"
He looked over at the coach, and McNamara nodded in agreement.
"Small mistakes. Stupid mistakes. Mistakes that we shouldn't be making. We should have had this game in the bag by now. We are by far the better team. You need to take a breath. You need to compose yourselves. Then you need to go out there and kick the shit out of them. We are the better team by far. Just go out there and prove it."
Several of the team cheered, but Gabe sat with his back against the locker, his hands in his lap. The manager looked over at him.
"Gabe, how are the knees?"
Gabe forced a smile. "All good, boss." Gattuso jutted his chin at him.
"A few times out there, you looked as if you were struggling."
"That's one way of saying it," said Babacar sourly.
McNamara flashed him a warning look, and Babacar turned away and drank from his bottle.
"I lost focus for a bit, boss," said Gabe. "It won't happen again."
"You're the captain, Gabe. Lead from the front."
"Yes, boss."
Gattuso nodded, then turned to McNamara.
"Joe, maybe go over the throw-ins on the playback. They're catching us unawares with those long throws."
"Will do, boss," said McNamara.
Gattuso nodded.
"Okay, I'll leave you to it. I'll go and keep the owner swede. But trust me, if we don't pull this game around, he'll be on the warpath."
He turned and walked out of the room. Gabe leaned back and banged his head against the locker door. Chapter 68. Tommy Kang stood up and stretched. Billy Huang waved his glass at the television.
"What do you think? Do you think Chelsea will win?"
Kang shrugged.
"You can see that Savage is doing his best," he said. "United could have scored, but he fucked up the pass, and then Chelsea got the throw-in and scored. If he can do that again..."
He went over to the sideboard and poured himself another brandy. He sipped his drink and then turned to look at Zhang and Huang.
"We need to get this tidied up before CK gets back."
"When will he be here?" asked Zhang.
"Game finishes at 4:45. The traffic will be bad."
He shrugged again.
"Half five, maybe."
Huang pointed at the ceiling. What about them? Do we deal with them before he gets here?
I don't know, said Kang. I guess that depends on who wins.
We're really going to let them go? Asked Zhang.
I don't know, said Kang. It'll be CK's call.
What do you think? Asked Wang.
They haven't seen our faces, said Kang. They don't know where they are. If we do release them, then there's a good chance Savage will keep quiet about it. If we finish them off.
He didn't finish the sentence.
But if United win, said Zhang. Then we'll be offing them for sure, said Kang. CK doesn't fuck about, and nor does Yongjo Lung.
He took another sip of brandy.
There's another possibility, though.
What's that? Asked Zhang.
If Chelsea do win, if Savage does as he's told, maybe he'll kill them all anyway. Savage and his family.
You think he'd do that? Asked Wang.
The fewer witnesses, the better, said Kang with a shrug. Me, I'd feel safer if they were all dead. But it's not my call. I am just a foot soldier in this.
He looked at his watch, then put down his glass.
I'm going to check on them.
He went upstairs, then paused in the hallway and listened. There was no sound from the bedroom. He pulled on his ski mask and pushed open the door. Chapter 69. The sat-nav showed that Lee's house was a few hundred yards ahead. He was in a quiet road, lined with trees, with large detached houses hiding behind high walls. There were no cars parked in the road and no pedestrians. It wasn't an area where people walked. Ray slowed the car as he drove by Lee's house. He couldn't see much of the building itself, but could see several SUVs parked in the driveway. There were two ornate wrought iron gates that were more than 10 feet tall, and to the left, a wooden door set into the high brick wall. Ray couldn't see any CCTV cameras, but he figured they must be there. He drove the full length of the wall, and when he reached the neighbouring house, he did a U-turn and drove back. He took a longer look at the gate, and this time spotted a Chinese man in bomber jacket and jeans. The wooden door led into a single-storey building to the left of the gates, which he guessed was probably where security were based. He couldn't see a back entrance, which meant the gates were the only way in. He pulled over at the side of the road and checked the gun he'd taken from Lee. He put the Glock on the centre console between the two seats and unclipped his seatbelt before pulling another U-turn and driving back to the gates. He pulled up at the side of the road, just past the driveway, and climbed out. He looked up and down the road as if he was lost, then walked towards the gates. The man in the bomber jacket stood in the middle of the driveway looking at him. He was in his 30s, with a crop of old acne scars across his cheeks.
"Is this number 19? He asked.
The man frowned.
What? Number 19. I'm looking for number 19.
The man was wearing a black leather jacket, and as he shrugged, Ray caught a glimpse of a gun in a shoulder holster.
No number,
he said.
Every house has a number, said Ray. That's how the postman knows where to deliver the mail.
He knew the house did have a number, 16, because it had been on Lee's driving license.
You're not a postman, said the second heavy.
He'd been standing in the building beyond the gate. He had a wrestler's build and a shaved head. He was wearing a long coat, and from the way his right hand was twitching, the garment was concealing something, and that something almost certainly spat bullets when the trigger was pulled.
No, that's right, but I have to collect a passenger.
You're a taxi? Asked Longcoat.
Uber, said Ray.
What's the name of the passenger?
Hunt, said Ray. Mr. Hunt.
Longcoat wrinkled his nose and shook his head.
No one called Hunt here, and we don't use taxis.
Ray sighed and peered through at the house. It was a modern steel and glass mansion, two glass-fronted wings either side of a main entrance that looked more like an upmarket car dealership than a family home. There were three black SUVs that he'd seen from the road, and beyond them a silver Mercedes.
Who owns this place, then? He asked. Must be worth a fortune.
The man in the long coats took a step closer to the gates, and this time Ray saw something black hanging from a nylon sling.
A gun. A big one. An Uzi, maybe. You should go, said the man. This is private property.
Ray couldn't see anyone else in the building behind the man in the long coat. So, just two guards both armed. Chapter 70. Laura looked over at the door as it opened, her heart pounding. It was the same man who'd given her water earlier. He was holding his gun and she swallowed nervously, her mouth so dry that she almost gagged.
"Is everything okay?" she asked.
Was the game over? Had United won? Was he there to kill her and Ollie? She had cut through most of the duct tape, but her wrists were still bound.
"It's half time," he said, walking over to Ollie.
"What's happening?" asked Laura.
"It's a draw so far," he said. 1-1.
Laura didn't know what to say.
"You better hope your husband does as he's told," said the man.
He stood over Ollie and checked the duct tape around the boy's ankles. Then he rolled Ollie over and looked at his taped wrists. Laura's breath caught in her throat. If he checked her bonds, he wouldn't fail to notice that she'd been cutting away at the tape. The man straightened up and walked towards her.
"Can I have some water?" she asked.
"I gave you water before."
"I need more," she said. "My mouth is so dry."
She coughed, hoping that would prove her point. She needed to distract him, to stop him turning her over and looking at her wrists. He sighed, then picked up the bottle of water from the bedside table. He put down the gun, unscrewed the cap, and held the bottle to her mouth. She drank slowly until he took the bottle away.
"Oh, thank you," she said.
He put the bottle back on the bedside table and picked up his gun. Laura squeezed the clippers in her right hand. There was no way he would fail to spot them if he rolled her over.
"I need to use the bathroom," she said.
"That's impossible."
"I need to pee."
He shook his head.
"Pee on the bed," he said.
"I can't do that."
He shrugged. He walked to the foot of the bed and tugged at the duct tape around her ankles.
"Please, just help me to the bathroom."
"I can't do that without untying you, and I'm not going to untie you."
"Please," she said, "you don't have to untie me. Just carry me to the toilet."
"The game will be over in 45 minutes. You can wait."
"That's what I'm telling you. I can't wait."
She paused, but it was clear the man wasn't convinced.
"Is this your house?"
She pressed him when he didn't answer.
"It's not, right? If I pee on the bed, the owner's not going to be happy, is he?"
"It's 45 minutes, not even an hour."
"I need to pee now, or at least put a towel under me."
"A towel?"
"From the bathroom. Put a towel under me so that the bed won't get wet."
Getting him to put the towel under her was a risk, but with any luck, he'd be so busy doing it that he'd forget about checking the duct tape. The man muttered under his breath and walked over to the bathroom. Chapter 71. Ray got back into the car and started the engine. He looked ahead and checked the mirror to make sure there was no traffic in the vicinity. Then he put the car in reverse. He pressed the button to lower the passenger side window and did the same with the driver's side. The two heavies were watching through the gate and he waved at them.
"Thanks, guys," he shouted. "You have a great day."
They stood impassively. Leather Jacket's right hand was patting his stomach. Long Coat's right hand was clenching and unclenching. Ray started to reverse slowly, steering with his left hand as he reached for his gun with his right. He swung the wheel and pulled into the driveway, hoping that the heavies would assume he was just reversing so that he could drive back the way he'd come. He watched them in the rearview mirror. Long Coat was saying something to Leather Jacket. Ray straightened up the Range Rover, took a quick look left and right, then slammed on the accelerator. The engine roared and the car shot backwards, smashing through the metal gates. Long Coat dived to the left of the car and Leather Jacket broke right. Ray hit the brake as he brought his gun to bear on Long Coat. As the man got to his feet, he reached into his coat and started to pull an Uzi on a nylon sling. Ray fired twice and both shots hit the man in the chest and he went down. As Ray looked to his right, he saw Leather Jacket pull out a handgun. Ray hit the accelerator again, and the car leapt back as the man fired. The shot went over the bonnet, and the man was swinging the gun back towards Ray as Ray brought his gun across his body and pulled the trigger, firing through the open window and hitting the man in the throat, more by luck than judgment. Blood spurted down the man's chest, and he staggered back, arms flailing. Ray reversed another few metres down the driveway, then climbed out of the car. He hurried over to Leather Jacket. The man was clearly dead, his eyes wide and staring. Ray picked up the man's gun, a Smith & Wesson, and put the safety on before tucking it into his belt. Then he dragged the man across to the gatehouse. He pulled the man inside. There was a sofa and a small table with two chairs and a window overlooking the gate. Ray dumped the body on the floor and then went out to get Longcoat. Longcoat was also dead. One of the shots had gone through his heart, and he'd bled out in seconds. Ray pulled him into the gatehouse, then picked up the man's Uzi. He checked the magazine. It normally held 25 rounds, but from what he could see through the slits into the side, there were about half that. He slotted the magazine back in place and started running towards the house. He had no idea how many others there were inside, but he was sure they would have heard the shots and would be expecting him. Chapter 72. Kang came out of the bathroom holding a towel. He'd heard a loud crashing noise and what sounded like gunshots. He dropped the towel on the bed and hurried over to the window. He peered through the blinds, but the bedroom was at the back of the house, and all he could see was the rear garden. He hurried over to the door. "What the fuck is happening?" he shouted downstairs in Cantonese. There was no answer. "What the fuck's going on?" he shouted. He moved cautiously along the hallway, looking down the stairs. Huang appeared, holding his Uzi. "There were shots at the gate." "Get out there and find out what's happening." Huang nodded and rushed down the hall to the front door. Kang looked behind him at the bedroom door, unsure whether to go down or stay with the hostages.